Every community has a place where people meet and stories are told. The East Coast has stoops, the South has porches, and in Alaska, we have Arctic entries.
Here, Alaskans share their personal stories, funny, sad, and sweet. These stories are originally told at a monthly event in Anchorage. At each live performance, seven people tell a seven-minute long, true story related to the show's theme.
I'm Cody Liska.
And I'm Rosie Robards. Welcome to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
Our theme for the show is In the Dark. We'll hear stories of hiding out, getting hoodwinked, and burning the midnight oil.
Up first, Olivia Cohn. She moved to Alaska from Chicago in 2013 to pursue her interests and professional career in environmental work. Her story takes place as that manic Alaska summer light puts her in the mood to try something outside her wheelhouse.
It's 5 a.m. on a Saturday in May, and I'm driving to Homer, completely exhausted but ready for adventure. I was driving to the Homer Ketchumak Bay Shorebird Festival, and the reason why I'm exhausted is it's about my 3 years into living in Alaska, and I quickly realized that you want to do everything you can in the summer, but you really can't just fit it all in. And so I said, this summer, I'm going to go to the Shorebird Festival, because things had come up the other summers, and I had two friends who committed to go with me, but their plans fell through at the last minute, so I'm like, I'm just going to go. And I camped down in Hope on Friday night, woke up super early in the morning because I couldn't sleep in my freezing sleeping bag, and I just got up and went. So I'm driving, and a couple other things I should tell you before I take you on this journey to Shorebird Festival with me is that, one, I definitely am not a birder, but I'm very interested in the natural world and the environment, so I'm super down with birds and with animals in the natural world. So one thing I could that sort of proves my non-preparedness for this birding festival is that I didn't even bring binoculars with me, which later proved to be a problem because people are like, oh, wow, look at that beautiful bird with all these like cool feather detail. And I'm like, yeah, I think it's a bird. So anyway, unprepared, on my way, no sleep. I guess I do have a little bit of an interest in birds too, though. From when I was a child, I used to go owling in Michigan. And if you haven't been owling, it's kind of amazing. It's a night hike, usually, and you go when there's typically a full moon and when it's winter. And in Michigan, we have all these oak trees and maple trees. So it's just like super bright and beautiful. And you go and you find an open spot and you play an owl call and you just kind of like wait. And then an owl swoops in. It's very magical. I recommend it. Anyway, back to Shorebird Festival. So I'm in Alaska, and I'm driving there, and I signed up for this stand-up paddleboarding course. I get to Homer, and I also had never been on a stand-up paddleboard before. And we were going to bird by stand-up paddleboard for 4 hours. So I get there and I like wetsuit up and we're stand-up paddleboarding and like trying to find birds, and it's kind of super amazing. It's one of those days in Homer when you can see the full mountain range, and so you're just kind of overcome by how spectacular it is. Well, I make some friends in my class and I say, hey, you guys, I had also noticed that on the schedule there's a bird call competition that's like right after our stand-up paddleboard class. Would anyone like to go with me? Because that sounds hilarious. And so I get a couple people who are like, yeah, sure, I'll go. And it starts 15 minutes after the stand-up paddleboarding. So at this point, I had maybe slept for like 4 hours, driven for about 3.5, was almost charged by a yearling too, and that's like the state of mind that I sort of felt kept staying with me throughout the day. And then stand-up paddleboarded for 4 hours. And so we get into the dock, we wetsuit up, our wetsuits off at the spit, and we head on over to the Shorebird Festival's bird call competition. And it's at the Homer Brewing Company, which is pretty small, but outside they had set up this stage, and it seemed pretty legitimate. There was like rows of seats next to it and some professional judges who had their scoring rubrics out. And they're like, there's two tracks to do this. Put your name in a hat. We pull people's names out. You can go up and tell your or do your bird call, but you let us know if it's like a serious or a non-serious track. And then people were very enthusiastic, very into it. And my favorites were when people wouldn't tell you what the bird call was going to be. They would just like do it. And they would be like, okay, I'm going to do this call. And then apologies to birders out there. Like I said, super down with you. I don't really know how to do this call, but this is what I heard. So my favorite ones are saying like, okay, you have to guess what this is. And they'd be like, and people would be like, oh my God, that's a red-breasted, ruby-throated, whatever. And then I'll be like really excited. And so I'm just like dying. I'm just like belly laughing. This is great. And then the ones that were really good was when it was like a mating call. So then the birds would be like, they'd be like, okay, I'm going to do this call, whatever. And they'd be like, to get like really crazy. And then people would be like, oh my God, it's the black-throated loon mating. And so I am just like crying, laughing. I had like a beer at this point, and I'm like, this Alaska is the best. So I'm kind of like standing there, and I am nudging my my new friend that I met. I'm like, hey, you should put a bird call in. And she was like, I don't know about that. That seems a little bit stressful. And I was like, yeah, okay. And we're like watching some more calls, and she's like, I'll tell you what, I'll do it if you do it. And I was like, ooh, I don't know. So a couple more calls, and I'm like, what the heck? I put my name in. I know one call. It's an owl call from, like I said, when I used to go owling as a kid, and my brother actually had asked me earlier that year if I knew any owl calls, and I did it for him, or knew any bird calls. I did it for him, and he was like, wow, Liv, that's a real trash garbage call. You're terrible. So this is what I have, so I'm just going to do it. So they call my name up pretty quickly. I didn't really have any chance to leave. And I get up and I do the call, and it was great. They're like, barn owl, because I was like, you know, I did the whole thing. Okay, I'm going to make you guess this call. And anyway, so it was very well received. I watched some more calls, and I was like, okay, that was great. The judges are deliberating, and I go, and I'm like, I want to go grab a beer and maybe use a restroom. And as I'm in the restroom, I hear just like this frantic knocking on the door. I'm like, excuse me, one moment. And it's my paddleboard instructor. And she's like, Olivia, we need you on stage, girl. And I was like, okay. And I like dry my hands and I run out. And the MC of the Shorebird Festival, who, by the way, this is not that important of a detail, but I thought it was amazing, had hand-painted puffins on his jeans. He'd flown in. He'd flown in from Oregon for this festival. Like, people were in. And he's like, really great bird calls this year. Really, really amazing bird calls. It's a call off. So so the call off is between like two other people and me. So luckily you had to redo the call that you'd already done. So the first person does the call and it was great. And the second person does the call and it was great. And I'm like, whoa, well now my skin's in the game. I'm gonna ham this up. So excuse me. So they call my name and I'm like, okay. And I like fly in to the stage. And then I did like, you know, well, very slowly. And then, you know, owls have a very large range of motion. So I did like a good head turn and I do my call and everyone's like, yeah. So then your harmonica threw me off. They start, the audience has to judge you by applause because the judges were done judging. So they put their hand over one person and they're like, Jenny or whatever her name was. And everyone's like, yeah. And then they're like, Johnny or whatever his name is. And everyone's like, yeah. And then they put their hand over my head and they're like, Olivia. And everybody's like, yeah. And that is how I became the 2015 Shorebird champion bird caller. I'm out of time, but I know I gotta do the call. Remember, it's a trash bird call.
Ho 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 ho! Ho! Ho!
That was Olivia Cohn, and this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour. During this hour, we hear Alaskans tell short, 7-minute stories about their lives.
Now we'll hear from Tika Ballas, a language arts teacher at Bagage Middle School, the executive director of Alaska Theater of Youth, a writer, and an artist.
So I grew up in a family full of secrets. And a lot of them were just really silly, like we introduced ourselves to the census taker as the Milktoast family, and we came from the planet 12 Famador. But some of our secrets were a little more serious, like the ones my brother and I couldn't talk about, not to our friends or our biological dad, like why the windows were always closed, the curtains drawn, and what my parents were growing in the backyard. And then some of the secrets were bigger. I was 11 and I had a secret pen pal. He was a friend of my parents. And one day he escaped the pen, the federal pen. And subsequently, our home was raided by police officers and federal agents at 6 o'clock in the morning on Memorial Day weekend. That's what upset my father the most. And for a really long time after that, we weren't allowed to play in the front yard. We had to stay inside and spy on the undercover agents outside our home. But some of our secrets were darker, and those mostly occurred in my biological father's home, and it took me a few decades to unravel those. But I left home really young, like really, really young. And when I was 19, a few years after I'd moved to Los Angeles, I began experiencing other people's secrets. And I got myself, at 19, finally, my first real job. I was a secretary of an office supply company out on La Brea, the main thoroughfare, in plain sight. This little itty-bitty house with its windows and doors all boarded up. So you had to enter from the side. It was super legit. My job was to answer phone calls of crying secretaries who had purchased overpriced office supplies, and I would transfer their calls to the operators in the room behind me. And then behind them was another room called the mail room. And I was strictly forbidden to ever enter the mailroom. Sometimes I saw things. And it turns out that this super legit office company was in fact just a front for the Hungarian mob. And we had these bi-weekly drills where we would have to run out the back of the building, hop into these white vans, and take off for an hour or two. And when I got back, we would have these fabulous buffets of food in these little white envelopes full of cash called job perks. So most of my life was really framed in all these fabulous secrets. So fast forward to just a few years ago, and I'm living here in Anchorage, and I'm running an art magazine, and my partner is running an art house, and a friend of ours runs a book publishing company. And together we share this super big passion for community and the arts and literature. So we start building this vision of something that will be a coffee shop bookstore and an art bar performance space, and we call it later the writer's block. And we start hunting for this building, and we find one that is just perfect, and it's oddly reminiscent of my mom. Mafia gig. It has no windows, it's surrounded by an 8-foot fence, and it's right on the main thoroughfare of Spinard in plain sight. And the owner hasn't told anybody that he's selling, so we have to go in and check it out and just browse. So imagine five of us enter this very small storefront, and we proceed to browse at the adults-only sex shop. Yeah, the merchandise is covered in like an inch of dust, and the signs, even though we can read the language, we just don't get it. Like, choose your favorite booth. Tokens only. Ms. Pac-Man. No pimps allowed. This place was filled with secrets, like 35 years of them. So I was estranged from my father most of my life, my biological father, for almost 30 years. And 6 years ago, when he died, I began this really painful process of blowing the cover off of all the secrets of my childhood that I'd been hiding from. And it turns out that hiding is a really safe way to exist, particularly for those who don't fit within the mold of societal norms. And my mother and stepfather are fringe people. They are bikers and hippies and thespians. And a lot of the secrets of my childhood are largely products of that. But there's a huge part of my childhood that was under the darkness, the shadow of misdeeds that began in my biological father's home. And when he died, I began to exhume him, to pull those secrets from my past through writing and filmmaking. And it was hugely cathartic, but it wasn't a lot of fun. And it turns out there's a lot of secrets and stories that I will never know the answers to. But I decided that to do that, I had to tear down a lot of walls. And it was oddly similar, but with the same kind of determination that we tore down the walls of the adults only store. We went in with a crowbar and sage and bleach. A lot of it. And we pulled those secrets out of those walls, those 4x4 booths with their TV monitors and their peepholes and their crawl spaces. And we found drugs and needles and condoms and wallets and a family photo. When we had about 7 months to wait for construction to move in, we invited all of these artists to inhabit that space, to occupy it. And one night there was this literary event. There was singing and dancing and poetry reading, and we were super immersed in this, crammed in there more than we ought to have been. And the door opens, and there's this guy standing there, and he is an adults-only patron. And we know this because of the look on his face. It was sheer horror. This is a space he'd always been able to inhabit it with in anonymity, but now he's got 75 sets of artsy-fartsy, poetry-loving eyes staring back at him, revealing and witness to his secret. When the bulldozer came in and tore that building down, I felt this enormous sigh, much like when I put my father's memory, the memories of my father, back into the ground, along with that acceptance that sometimes not all secrets get to be revealed. And it's with this huge triumphantness of knowing that this accomplishment in January, the writer's block is going to open, and there is going to be food and coffee and beer and wine and literature and music, but there is going to be no more secrets. There will be no need to hide. There's just going to be a lot of windows, lots of windows.
That was Tika Ballas, and the writer's block is located at 3965 Spinard Road.
You're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour, and we're hearing stories of hiding out, getting hoodwinked, and burning the midnight oil. Our theme is In the Dark. Our next storyteller, Ben Bruhn, is 16 years old and a junior at West Anchorage High School. He first told his story as part of the StoryWorks Alaska program in his English class.
So everything good in my life began when I was in preschool. It was where I learned to play soccer and met all my friends and started learning to read and write, and I loved it. And I especially loved my classroom. And in that classroom, we had this dog, and it wasn't a real dog. It was a kind of a clay figurehead. And in the middle of it, there was a red button, and it played the song, you know, the "Who Let the Dogs Out?" You know, no. So anytime anyone was having a rough time or just a bad day, anyone could go and you push that button and you just start dancing. And it brought the whole overall vibe of the room up, and whoever was sad, I mean, it was great. Now, a couple weeks later, my mom and I, we go to Fred Meyer's. Now, I love going to the store. I don't know what is about it. Seeing all the new faces and shiny things on the shelves and everything, it was awesome. Now, my mom was a little bit different. She's on a mission when she goes to the store. I mean, half an hour before, she's got her list ready. She's ready. We go into the store. She's got her cart. I mean, she's cooking. She's going through the aisles, not even stopping. They're just waving the groceries in there. And, I mean, I was 4 years old, so I had around, you know, a foot of leg, and so it was hard for me to keep up. I would, you know, run, and catch up and take a little break, and then run, and take a break, and I would end up just telling my mom, "We'll meet back in 5. You go do your thing." So on my little journey through the store, I found myself in this aisle, and I was walking through it, and it was this golden aisle. And I'm about halfway through the aisle, and I look left, and I see this magazine. And it has a dog of the Who Let the Dogs Out dog on the front of it. And instantly, I think, that's mine. But then I think, my mom, I mean, that's stupid. Why would you buy that? And so I, without thinking twice, I take it, and I put it under my shirt, and I wrap it around, and I stick my hands in my pockets. And at first, everything felt good. I was like, it was right at my level. I didn't have to climb anything. everything was good. And so I walked through the store a little bit, trying to go look for my mom. And I was noticing no one said anything. I was like, wow, this is really working. I'm just kind of going here. And I finally meet up with my mom, and my heart just sinks. Of course she knows. But strange enough, she didn't. But I still felt that guilt. But I wasn't just going to put it back. That's just not who I am. So I started leaving hints. I would kind of dance around with my hands in my pocket, and she didn't notice anything. Mom on a mission. She's got her stuff going down. We finally get to the cash register, and I'm like, holy crap, she better notice. Otherwise, I don't know what I'm going to do. And so I'm, this is it. I'm dancing, I'm looking at her, I'm like, look, mom, I got this giant ass rectangle on my stomach. And so she doesn't notice. And so I find myself walking further and further until finally we're out at the door. And I close the car door, and I'm like, oh, you dumbass. I just reflected over everything of where I could just, I could have put it back there and no one would have saw me. But we get home, and I feel so bad that when we open the door, I'm like, mom, and she turns around, and I lift my shirt up. Of course, my dad comes around the corner, and he's like, did you steal that? So instant punishment. We go back to Fred Meyer's, and they put me in this room, and and I remember looking at this this kind of like this silhouette, this outline of a man, and he's bald, and he has glasses, and he kind of has a tie and a short sleeve button down shirt, and he holds up a picture next to his face, and it's a picture of me, and he puts it up on a wall, and he says, every time you come in here, we'll know to watch for you. Now, I'm 4 years old, and I'm scared shitless. I didn't go back to Fred Meyer's for 3 years. So, yeah, Fred Meyer's is rough. I finally go back to Fred Meyer's, and I'm with my mom again, and I notice they have those food detectors. The things where you go out and if you didn't pay, and it goes boo, woo, 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 and there's always that one dude that's like, oh, it was an accident, So I'm in Fred Meyer's again, and I'm like, when did they put these up? And my mom's like, oh, I don't know, around 3 years ago. And I was just, oh no. I thought that I was the reason that Fred Meyer's had put those food detectors up there. Why else would they, But it wasn't till last year when I was doing StoryWorks that I found out my parents' side of the story. Now, my dad has a friend that works the security detail at Fred Meyer's. He called him up and he said, hey, I need you to scare my kid. And he's like, dude, it's Sunday night. I'm going home. He's like, what should I do? Call the cops. I'm not calling the cops on my 4-year-old son. And so that's when they took me to the room to meet the bald guy who ended up just being the manager. And all those pictures up on the wall were Employee of the Month pictures. Thank you.
That was Ben Brune, and you're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour. Each year, Arctic Entries supports local organizations through ticket sales. So each time you pay for a ticket to one of the live shows, the profits from the sale go to a local nonprofit.
This fall, our nonprofit partner was Hospice of Anchorage, an organization which offers care and grief support for those in our community who are anticipating or experiencing death or the loss of a loved one.
Terry Kimple was kind enough to share this story about how Hospice of Anchorage has helped her family. Fair warning, this story does, of course, deal with death and grief. Here's Terry.
I always knew that I wanted to be a mother. I wanted to be called Mama, Mommy, Mom, or as I always said in my teen years, Mother. I just never knew it was going to be such a journey for me. I met my husband, Tom, back in 1994. We knew we wanted to have kids, but I had just started a new career as a flight attendant. We were enjoying my travel benefits, the perks of that type of a lifestyle. 12 years into my career and 5 surgeries, a lot of medication, a lot of doctor visits, 5 failed IVF cycles later, we got that blood test. We got that positive pregnancy test. We were sitting at our doctor's appointment on our 6th IVF cycle, waiting for our ultrasound, talking about the road we've been on. As we're looking at the test, the screen there, I'd had so many of these tests in the past. I looked at Tom, see if he saw what I was seeing. By the look on his face, I could tell he was seeing just what I was seeing. We had 2 flickers, 2 heartbeats. We were having twins. We were so excited. We couldn't believe the luck. All of this heartbreak, everything we had gone through up until this point, the sorrow, the disappointment, the loss, led us to this. We knew this was our destiny. We were supposed to be parents of these twins. Fast forward to 32 weeks, 2 days in my pregnancy. Everything was fantastic. We found ourselves at the hospital. I delivered my twins C-section. Addison came first, 4:54 in the afternoon. She was absolutely beautiful. She weighed a mere 3 pounds, 7 ounces, had red hair, long skinny fingers. Just a beautiful baby. Her younger brother, Grayson, came a couple minutes later, 3 pounds, 11 ounces, blonde hair, a wrinkly forehead, just like his dad. They whisk the babies away quickly, as they do all newborns, clean them up and take temperatures and such. We were reunited shortly thereafter. Tom and I began the next 8 days learning how to become parents. We learned all the things parents do, how to change diapers, feed our new babies, take temperatures, even how to hold them. They were so small, we'd never handled babies so tiny before. Then on that 9th day, everything changed. Grayson was in distress that morning. The doctors told us he was going to need surgery. He was going to need a major surgery. We had no idea that 12 hours later, we would be standing at his isolette, watching the staff, the nurses and doctors, administering CPR to my son. As we stood there, their success, sorry, they were not successful. They were frantically disconnecting the wires and cables and monitors from him. They handed me him and said, "Terry, now it's time to say goodbye." I stood holding my son, telling him how much I loved him, apologizing that I couldn't save him. He died in my arms. The next 47 days, I spent in the NICU, determined to get my daughter Addison out of there alive. They didn't know what had happened with my son, why he had, things had gone bad so quickly. I took notes of everybody that came and went, all the drugs they had administered, what time, what staff, any tests they had run. None of those things mattered. On that 47th day, we finally were able to take Addison home. She was able to pass all of their requirements to be discharged. We got her home. Tom and I started our routine of caring for a newborn. She was less than 5 pounds. I felt I could do this. I could go through the motions. I found myself standing one day washing bottles, looking down at her in the bassinet next to me. I just started sobbing. The pain from losing Grayson was there every minute, every single minute. I needed somebody to help me with that pain. I remembered when we discharged, they gave us some paperwork with the numbers, if you need any help, that type of thing. I didn't pay any attention to it at the time. I just wanted out of there. I went back to look through that paperwork and found a number for Hospice of Anchorage. The woman who answered the phone didn't have much time that day, but she did agree to meet with me. Once I was sharing my feelings with her, she stayed with me for hours and let me just vent all my confusion, my love for my daughter, my pain for my loss of my son, the confusion of how to deal with this and move forward in my life. She introduced us to a program, Forget-Me-Nots, for parents who've lost their child. We started attending meetings that next week. And through that program, we've met some of the most amazing people who really understand. They've lost children. They understand what we've been through, what we're going through. They've given us hope. They've given me the understanding that there is light at the end of that tunnel. I wanted to be here tonight in the hope that sharing the story of my son, he only had 9 days here, but he was a member of our community. And I'm hoping that his memory will stay with each of you by hearing his story tonight. Today is December 5th, 2017. My twins are 4 years old today. I want to wish my baby girl, Addison, a happy birthday. I love you so much, honey. And to our little love, Grayson, we miss you every single minute of every single day. But the happiest birthday to you as well, honey. Thank you.
That was Terry Kimball, and this is KSKA 91.1 FM Anchorage. Thank you, Terry.
In case you hear a story you'd like to share with a friend, all the past Arctic Entries stories are available for listening on our website at arcticentries.com, as well as through iTunes and SoundCloud. You can listen to this show in its entirety at alaskapublic.org.
Here's something a bit different for everyone. We're about to hear from a duo. Corey and Jenny Jackson, a couple from the Matsu Valley, have been married for 6 years and have been foster parents for 4.
Oh, I know, we're so sweet. I'd like to preface our story by saying our family is not normal. No. I don't know that any families in foster care are. But if one thing rings true over the last 4 years of working with so many foster families, it's that we are as unique as the children entering our homes. And what we are sharing tonight is just part of our journey.
So at 11 o'clock in the evening on December 13th, 2015, I get a call from my beautiful bride. There's a baby in the emergency room. They just need us to hold her overnight. Can you call the caseworker? Just hear what she has to say. And I realize no is probably the right answer. But please just call and hear what she has to say.
So I was already on duty, paramedic supervisor in Wasilla, so I'm out and about in my little chase car and gotten a call that, like my husband said, there's a baby who needs to be held in the ER. We're full. Our family is full and busy, but we can do that. We can hold a baby overnight. I hoodwinked my husband. got him to come down in case I run calls, and we went straight to the ER, and I got there quite quickly, met the caseworker at the counter, and as I walked in the ER, I could hear her crying. And I could see this tiny blonde baby in room 3 of the ER in her birth mother's arms, and the caseworker standing at the counter. And she was just so small and so angry. I could see angry and small from the counter. And I walked up to the caseworker, and she's shocked that I was there so quickly, and starts into a very sad story. There's little known about her. We don't know her birth date. There's a lot of confusion, a lot of confliction. She's not well. We're going to monitor her overnight. And by the way, can you take her home in the morning? We don't have a family lined up. I am there in my battalion chief uniform, mid-shift, and I literally said to the caseworker, yeah, no, oh, ask my husband. I went in to meet the birth mom and introduced her to my family via photos. Apparently, we'll be taking care of your baby. What is her name? How do you hold her? Does she have a feeding schedule? What soothes her? As quick as you can get to know some of the most private details of someone and their baby, what's her middle name? It took us a year to learn our previous daughter's middle name, so it seemed really important at the time.
So I get to the emergency room and I meet the caseworker and I get a little more of the story. She looks at me and she says, your wife was kind of weird about this, but can you guys take her home? And I chuckled, yeah, of course we can take her home. Next thing I know is we're in the mother-baby unit in Matsu Regional.
And this is where it gets really surreal for me. Again, battalion chief uniform. I did not start this shift with a baby. I'm halfway through a 24-hour shift, and now we have these hospital bands that are tying us to this tiny crying creature. Watching my husband rock and try to soothe her as I'm kicked back on the couch in a hospital room that is now ours, and a baby. Did I mention they gave us a baby?
So throughout the night, as she said, we're trying to calm this little velociraptor down and trying everything we can, sang every Judy Buffett song I know. Didn't work. She kept getting worse and worse, and eventually got to the point where they had to take her back to the nursery. A few hours later, doctor came back and said, she's decompensated, guys. And those who don't know, that means she's really doing bad. She's going to be going to the NICU at Providence. And
at this point, I had one of my fellow battalion chiefs come relieve me at the hospital. We'd only met her a couple hours before, and we knew we would walk through fire for her. She didn't deserve to be alone. She didn't deserve to be sick. So Battalion Chief Brown came and relieved me at the hospital, and I went in the ambulance to the NICU at Providence with the NICU team. It kicked off a very long, dark, lonely, hard 3 weeks of our life.
In the NICU, and for those who have never been, and thank God for that, you're in a single room. You have to keep the lights down, though, because even light hurts these kids. You're tethered to the wall. You've got maybe a 5-foot swath that you can go. You cannot put her down. We kangaroo cared her. So for those who don't know what that is, it's skin-to-skin contact. And 3 weeks, well, 2.5, of having a little tiny velociraptor stuck to your chest in 24-hour shifts was quite possibly one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life. She squawked so much, I started calling her my magpie. I resorted to earplugs on numerous occasions.
It's hard to have such a physical connection with someone so sick. She lived on our chest. She was never in an isolette. She was never in a crib. It was a big success when PT finally got her in a swing for 10 minutes. Within a day, she only wanted my husband or I. And so she lived on our chest. You felt the withdrawal coming. You felt the fevers, the sweats, the vomit, the profuse diarrhea. It was awful. But it wasn't all dark. One of the bright spots for us was when you started to see the personality under the sickness, the glimpses of this fierce little warrior. I'll never forget the first time my husband held her out from his chest and she looked at him and took him in. Her face wasn't tight in a grimace and sickness, but actually checking us out. She's not always an angry dinosaur. Another bright spot for us was the hospital chaplain, James. We were no contact. OCS didn't want us having visitors or family. They were afraid of a flight risk and other social drama, so we were alone. And this chaplain brought light into a very dark corner of the NICU for us. He came to me on a very bad day. We'd been up all night. She'd not made it to a rescue dose of morphine. And I told him I've been very selfish over the night. I've been despairing. I've been missing my family. We're here over the holidays. I have a 2-year-old at home, and we just put up a Christmas tree. But you know, she's doing a little bit better this morning, and I realize it's not about me, and it's not about my husband. It's about this baby, and she needs us, whether it's just for today or for a week or a month. She needs us right now, and this is probably the most Christ-like thing I've done. So, you know, haha, Christmas. And without missing a beat, he leaned forward and he quietly said with a smile, "You know, there is a story about a baby that needed a place to go at Christmas." Got me good. For our family, there is a happy ending. We adopted our precious magpie after 18 months in foster care. She's amazing, and she's still a velociraptor. But she's perfect, and she's precious, and she is a much-needed light in our family, and she is adored by all of us. We closed our foster license in August after her adoption. Having adopted 3 kids in 3 years, we were done.
So you think. At 4 o'clock in the morning, Halloween of this year, my beautiful bride calls me again from the emergency room. There's a child here. She has nobody. She has nowhere to go. Apparently our foster journey is not yet over. Thank you.
That was Corey and Ginny Jackson on KSKA 91.1 Anchorage. I'm Cody Liska.
And I'm Rosie Robards. Our next Arctic Entry storyteller is Tim Nixon, who says he came to Alaska as soon as he could.
In Alaska, we have many challenging and often dangerous jobs. And along with that work can come tragedy. Tim shares a story with us about friendship and loss.
I'm a paramedic and a nurse, and I work on an air medical helicopter with Corey, actually. On the good days, you may see us when the fire department closes down the highway so that we can land on a big open area and swoop away with someone from a car accident. Or you might hear me brag about flying up and enjoying the smooth scenic ride up to base camp on Denali. On the less good days, we trust our pilots as we strap in and let them squeeze us into a tiny landing zone on a winding tree-lined back road, or get beat around in the wind as we fly off to a rural emergency department to fly away with the sickest of the sick. Ever since I was a 12-year-old kid, for the first time watching a big white medevac helicopter land on the school's ball field, I knew that this is what I wanted to do. And still, after almost 20 years of landing on other people's ball fields and highway intersections, it's just about the only thing that I can see myself doing. But it's dangerous, and that's something that we always remember. There are other professions that have more deaths. Fisheries, logging, firefighters, cops, for sure. But there's a lot more of them, too. There's only about 8,000 people in the U.S. that do what we do. And since 1980, we've killed 407 of them. So I came here tonight to tell you the story of 3 of those names. My friends, Lance Brabham, John Stumpf, and Cameron Carter, who 10 years and 2 nights ago, on December 3rd, 2007, another Tuesday night, left us when the helicopter that we shared fell into the icy waters of Prince William Sound, just outside of Whittier, just after dark, taking them and their patient that was their task and their singular purpose that night. I could spend all the time that I've got and more telling you about each of them, telling you about John, the nurse from New Hampshire that transplanted first to Nome and fell immediately in love with the wild and free Alaskan life. Or about Lance, the gentleman pilot and true scholar who was never satisfied until every detail of a flight was just perfect. Or about Cameron, the bright paramedic, brand new to us, who always had a smile on his face, and whose enthusiastic reply to most everything, "Okay, sweet," was kind of his trademark and known pretty far and wide. Cameron, who would have turned 25 just a few days after their memorial service. I thought that I wanted to spend all my time telling you how their deaths impacted our small team, how every day for the week that the search for a helicopter was ongoing, we'd gather twice a day, like family, and hold hands and hold each other and hope and ask for peace. And how even so, all of us are still haunted because while on the afternoon of the 5th day, they found John and were able to bring his body back to us, but the helicopter was never recovered. And so Lance and Cameron and their patient are still out there somewhere, along with any clues to knowing what might have actually happened out there that night. I wanted to tell you how, for me, after a year, I still took walks late at night by myself, cursing at the stars and wondering what cruel twist of scheduling fate meant that it was those guys out there that night and not me, and what I had done to deserve to be spared. And how well-meaning folks would come to me and say that they were very sorry for what happened to us, but they were glad that I was safe, because that's what I wanted to hear. How after 2 years, I would sometimes take icy cold showers, often in the dark, trying to imagine what those last moments were like for them. And how at the 3-year mark, nearly half of our small group's marriages had ended, including my own. But as I worked to put that story together, I realized that now, 10 years and 2 really dark nights out, the story isn't anymore about the lives that they lost, but it's about how those lives that they lost have changed the ones that we live. And so to that end, I wanted to spend my time to try and answer the question that my original version begged: why is it that you still do this anyway? We lead really high-profile work lives, complete with flashing lights and sometimes sirens, but we're not adrenaline junkies. In fact, I've often found that my generally fairly dull personality and calm disposition is a really big help sometimes in just taking a deep breath and taking control of a room and working the problem that's in front of us. But I think what the loss of Lance and John and Cameron really taught me is to not just take that breath, but to really experience the moment and notice all the details that I might not have otherwise, the kind of details that add up to the vivid memories of a career spent in service to others. And now it's in those details that I can feel those guys' presence most clearly. One night I'm alone in the emergency room with the family of a man that's nearing the end of his own road, an elder that was found face down in the snow outside his home in the village. Out on the tundra, nothing is easy, and the weather and darkness meant that it was several days before they were able to get him to this small hospital in Bethel. He's unconscious and cold on a ventilator, my IV pump running in medicines to twist his vital signs around to my liking. Blood is leaking into his brain, and it's really only a matter of time. A member of the family approaches me and asks if it would be okay if they offered him a prayer while we waited. Of course, I say, take all the time that you need, and don't be afraid to touch him or talk to him. He can't talk back because of the medicines and the ventilator, but he can hear you. A white lie, almost certainly, but these are moments for the living. I stand quietly as they gather in a circle and join hands and bow teary faces, and though I can understand none of their language, I can tell that their words are clearly a very Catholic prayer and words of hope. These are special moments that I'm privately witness to out here, 1,000 miles from anywhere. A different day, back on the helicopter in a different town, I'm walking along the ice road on Big Lake, a few steps behind the stretcher that's being pushed by my partner and the ambulance crew that we just met. One of the crew, a young, eager, brand new EMT, holds tightly onto the breathing tube that I'd just inserted, looking to me occasionally for affirmation as he squeezes in the long, slow breaths that I'd just taught him. I tap him on the shoulder and say, "You're doing fine, kid." He smiles really big and says, "Sweet, thanks." We load in the helicopter, and as we take off, I get a quick glance to the north, and the big mountains are out. And we turn back towards Anchorage, and I see my own reflection in the window, and behind me, the reflections of Lance and John and Cameron, watching over us as they always do. It's been a long road getting here, to this point in my career, to this station in life, to the community that we found, and back, finally, to some peace. My life since the accident has been decorated with moments like these. Lance and John and Cameron took off into the dark that night, pursuing a job that they loved, but not work that they ever would have wanted to die for. And although I would give anything to have them back, I know that their deaths were not in vain, because I know that my life is much better for the legacy that they left behind. I don't know how long it takes for the hurt to stop, but I know this. I'm here today in no small part. I'm here today not in spite of the accident, but in no small part because of it. But mostly, I'm here today because I miss my friends. And here I get to see just a little bit of them every day in everything that we see. Thanks for listening.
That was Tim Nixon at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts, and this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA 91.1 FM.
Our last storyteller for this show comes from the StoryWorks Alaska program. Her name is Nika Angela Mockereg, and she is a proud believer in the magic of the Christmas season.
Before I start, I just wanted to take a vote and see how many of you guys actually do believe in Santa Claus. And okay, so if you do believe in Santa Claus, I want you guys to say, I believe, on the count of three, okay? So one, two, three. Oh, that's actually a lot more than I thought. Okay, well, that's a good thing. Okay, well, I believe too, and that's actually because I was born in the Philippines. And not to like stereotype any other Filipinos out there, but in the Philippines, we take Christmas very seriously from late October to early January. It's basically Christmas time, okay? Like, I'm very serious. Like, in the news, there was this calendar. Like, they'd always end it with, like, oh, there's, like, 24 days of Christmas. Like, counting down till Christmas. And there's so many decorations around and so many stories. And so, of course, being the stubborn and enthusiastic child I was, I listened to almost all of the Santa Claus stories, and I believed it 100%. And I just want to say why I believed in it and why I love so much about, like, the Santa Claus stories is because basically just shows that you could be kind and generous without having anything given back to you. And I just love that. And when I moved to Anchorage when I was 4 years old, I carried that belief with me. And as soon as I learned how to like speak English and get used to everything, the first word like I said was, hey, Santa Claus is real. Like to everyone around me, like, hey, do you know that Santa Claus is real? Like to all my classmates. And of course they were like, oh yeah, yeah. And I was like, yeah, be a good person. You know, be a good person to meet Santa Claus. And I was just spreading the like Christmas spirit all around me. But like, as I grew older, I started to realize that people around me, they just started to, you know, kind of fade away from that. And I was like, what's going on? You know, like, why is no one paying attention to me? Or like, when I say Santa Claus is real. And I just started to kind of hide that belief because, you know, when we grow up, we just start to lose belief in everything. And I just kind of want to fit in, you know, like fit in a bit. And to fit in, I kind of just started to stay quiet about Santa Claus and just not be that girl that like, don't talk to her. She's just going to like start talking about Santa Claus with you and like give you life lessons. So like I was like, okay, I'll just start it to just be quiet. And the only time like I will kind of give you like a peek of how like strong my obsession with Santa Claus is like if you were a really close friend and we were just like kind of having an argument whether Santa Claus is real or not. And I know it was kind of bad for a child pretty young, but this is what kind of was happening. Last year, late December, I was going to Michael's with my sister, and I was actually going there to get supplies for this math project that I totally procrastinated on, but that's okay. But as I was in the car, I was actually texting one of my close friends, and we sent like over 30 text messages with pictures too about like whether Santa Claus was real or not. And of course, I was fighting the side that was like, yeah, he's real. And he was like, no, he's not. And I just started like sending him pictures of like Santa Claus on rooftops, you know? Like, and like, I was like, oh yeah, would a parent actually do this for a child like that bad, you know? And so, but sadly, like 25 text messages in, I started to realize that, oh, he's actually winning. Like, and that was not only upsetting, but surprising because that never really happened to me. Like, not in like the other debates I had, but like, it was kind of like surprising. Like, I didn't expect for him to actually win. And so I was starting to like go back to how I was back then, whereas like, I was just kind of staying quiet, you know? And so as me and my sister arrived at Michael's, I turned off my phone, I put it in my pocket and I went out the car. And I was like to my sister, please, I need time to breathe. Like, I need time, you know? I went through a hard argument right now. I need time to separate. So I just entered Michael's with a straight face and I was like, I'm just gonna get the supplies. And so as I passed the frame aisle though, I noticed that there was this man with a white beard, white long beard, okay? And he had like the Santa physique, you know? Like, like, at first I was like, oh, that's cool. A man that looks like Santa Claus. So I just like passed by the aisle. But then I like took a step back and I was like, wait a minute. And so like, I almost had like a whiplash because I turned my head so fast. And okay, to be honest, I like stared at him for about over a minute, probably. Just like staring at him, and I was like, is this actually happening to me? Like, is this real? And so I was like, no, wait. I need to get my sister like to get another person's input. And so I like went to go find my sister, and trust me, it only took 2 minutes. I'm not joking. So when I returned back, he was gone. Okay. Whoa. So like, like my head was like, oh my gosh, I just met him, you know, like, like, holy guacamole, is this happening? And so I was like, Angelica, like my sister's name's Angelica, by the way. And I was like, Angelica, let's go find him right now. So like, we just like ran all around the square. Well, I ran, and my sister was like, oh my God. Like, you know, like he's not there. And I was like, oh my God, no. I actually have to like to talk to him, you know, like I have to see if he's real. And I couldn't find him. And then my sister was like, Nika, can we just please go? Like, let's just pay for the stuff. You have to do your project. And I was like, okay, fine. And so we went to the cashier and we paid. And I was literally like, should I like ask the cashier to call him in the intercom? Like, and then like, I was like, should I just do it? Like it happened to me before and I know it works. Like, I just want them to say like, Santa Claus, can you please come to the front? There's like a kid that is looking for you. But like my sister was like giving me that. She was like, don't. She was like, don't. And so I was like, okay. Like, I was just like, okay. And so I paid for it, and I just remember the argument, and I was like, I took it out of my back pocket, and I was like, I just met Santa Claus. Like, periods in between to like, you know, emphasize it. Like, I just met Santa Claus. And to the guy, and then he was like, no, I don't believe you. Because he knew like this argument wasn't over. So of course he texted back instantly. He was like, no, I don't believe you. You're crazy. But like, you know, at that moment, I just like, I kind of really didn't care. I was so open with that about it. And I was really proud of myself for being open about it to a close friend. And I know that, okay, maybe he wasn't the real Santa Claus. I didn't really have my glasses that day. Okay, so like, I only saw like the outline of him. I kind of saw little details, I'm gonna be honest, but I kind of took it as a sign, you know, to see that, to like, for me to see that I shouldn't be afraid of what others think. And I actually found that my friends do actually like this side of me, and they appreciate that I've been more open about it. And so, for you guys that didn't say I believe, okay, I know I didn't probably convince you, or maybe I did, but what I did learn from everything is that I am a proud believer, and I am really happy that I am. So thank you guys for everything, and Merry Christmas. Owen! And if you guys do meet Santa Claus, I'm trying to find him this year again at Michael's, so contact me.
Happy holidays, everyone. That was Nika Makareg, and this has been the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. To hear these stories again, or to share them with friends, visit arcticentries.com or alaskapublic.org.
The Arctic Entries website also has information about upcoming themes, live shows, and details on how you could tell a story.
We'd like to thank our storyboard and the storytellers for the show, all of whom are volunteers, by the way. The proceeds from our shows are donated to a local social services nonprofit. Information about this is also on our site.
Thanks to Anchorage's own Super Saturated Sugar Strings for our theme music. And this show was edited at the Alaska Teen Media Institute by Kendall Stormo. This has been the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Rosie Robards.
And I'm Cody Liska. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to hearing your stories.
Where will we go? What will we be? I want to be yours, but I want to be free. What will we do when times get tough? Improve our life or play from the rough?